Yeah, very good. Well, it is. It's a privilege to be with you, and how exciting to see this group together. I was excited when I heard this event was going on, and then to just notice all of the discussion. What a great event. So I'm really honored to be a part of it here today. So I'm one of the counselors there at ACCFS in Morton, and that's part of what brings me here. I grew up in a home where we did a lot of foster care. And we had some that came for a few days, some that were for a few weeks, and others that were there for a long time. And so that kind of led me into part of wanting to be a helper and moving into counseling. And then after graduation, I began working at Lutheran Social Services. And in that setting, I would work with kids that were in foster care that had been removed from the home, some that were trying to reunite with biological parents, and sometimes my counseling then would involve the biological parents or parents that were fostering or adopting. And in that, I just saw a profound impact that the home had on kids, that when they would move into a safe and stable place, like there was something that happened there, and it just piqued my interest. What is going on here? But then over time, I noticed too that there was something underlying that still wasn't necessarily impacted by a safe and stable home. And so then that led me into just thinking about that and what's at play here, and that led me into attachment and attachment theory. And so I'm sure there's some of you in the audience today that know more about this than I do, and others of you that maybe don't know much about it at all. But I think when we're thinking about adoption, foster care, it's a topic that would be worth some time to at least contemplate and to consider today. So that's what I'm hopeful to step into, and I'm hopeful really to do it from a lens of giving you information about what it is, the impacts of it, and then how that can help direct us, but hopefully in a way that stirs up encouragement, rather than sometimes it can be really good at pointing out all the things that we didn't do right or well, and that's certainly not the intention here. You may feel some of that, but that's not really the heartbeat. So attachment theory really rests on the reality that we know as believers that we've been created as relational beings, being created in the image of God, the triune God. Therefore, we are relational. And that's really what's bared out in the social scientists. Watch people interact, and they observe and say, what's going on here? And they conclude things like, oh, there's something going on in this attachment arena. It's their observation of what we know to be true that's revealed in the scriptures. And I would say relationships are really built on assumptions. And so attachment theory really helps us think about what are the relational assumptions that are there, and how do they impact behavior, and then how can we maybe shift those relational assumptions that have been established through, whether, like Kenya had mentioned earlier, like some of the genetics that are there that we carry coming into the world or we experience early on in life and then move forward. That really, our relational experiences do have a significant impact on that intuitive playbook that she laid out so well for us this morning, and that maybe attachment theory is part of what that intuitive playbook really rests on, and some of the things that we see flows out of attachment. And a very big kind of high-level 30-foot view, the basic deal is that attachment is categorized in two different ways, either secure attachment or insecure attachment. And you can think of secure attachment as relational interaction that's like reciprocal, that you interact, and then there's interaction back, and that impacts you, and then you impact them, and there's this back and forth, this really beautiful interplay between two people that is just kind of life-giving. Whereas insecure attachment, really, because of the assumptions and some of the wounds that have happened, really approaches relational interaction more with a battle plan in mind. That it's something that you have to defend against, or something that you have to protect against, this relational interaction. Something that's been designed to be life-giving is actually quite threatening. And that's part of what maybe underlies the insecure attachment. And so before we get too far, again, just to say that early life experience does have an impact. And I think it's important as parents for us to recognize what we do matters. Like how we interact with our kids and kids that are doing well or kids that are hurting and struggling, those things really matter. And for us to think about that and be thoughtful about that, but also to be careful that parenting isn't everything, attachment isn't everything, that it all doesn't rest on our shoulders, and that I've seen far too many situations of parents that have done really well, have been really faithful to the role that they've been called to, and things don't turn out the way that they would like. And I think that's reality. And those that maybe we would say haven't done quite as well turn out in a really wonderful way by God's grace. And so just my hope is, again, not to lead you into fear that every interaction is like, oh man, I got to get this right or else. Because that is just going to ramp your system up and really prevent you from being able to engage the interactions that are right there in a way that's based on who you are as a relational being and how God's created you. And we want that to be able to happen. But when fear reigns, it moves us out of that and into just panic, and then we aren't able to engage those interactions the way that we'd really like. So this graphic here just kind of outlines at a very high level some of what I would say that we've been created as a relational being to move into relationships, that we're hardwired for connection. Last night, we were with some family that we hadn't been with for a little bit, and they've got some infants. And you see a mom and a dad or an aunt and an uncle or me that they haven't seen for a while, like smile and doing all these goofy things to get them to respond. And eventually, after like, okay, it looks like mom and dad are okay with this, then they smile, and then I smile back, and there's this reciprocal back and forth. And it's not, it's a really silly thing to observe, but it's a profound thing that's starting to shape the mind and the brain and the relational assumptions that come from those interactions. And so this is part of what this is trying to outline. If you see in the center, it talks about the caregiver, and it has some arrows that are kind of the different places that the caregiver interacts in this interaction, and then on the outside is the child. So if we start at the secure base, and the next thing, and this would be the child, when they are by a secure base, they're by a caretaker that is secure and can be protective, then that helps regulate their emotions, and they're able to move into a place of calm. And when they're calm, then they're able to go out and explore their world, whether that's going and playing with a new toy, or, you know, they're on a playground, and then they're like, you know what, seems safe, now I'm going to kind of venture off into the woods. And exploration, and that looks a lot different from age to age. And then, by just living in a world where there are threats, they're going to perceive a threat, like, oh no, something is not quite right here. And when they do, they're going to experience distress. And then when they experience distress, if the caretaker is attuned, they might notice that distress, and the child's going to seek proximity towards that caretaker, and the caregiver is going to then welcome that pursuit, and then the emotions calm again, and those interactions happen thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And when that happens well, it helps build the assumption that, you know, on one side of the scale, you know what, I'm lovable, like, I matter, I have value and worth, and that I can count on other people. People will be there, they're going to be there to help me and protect me and care for me, and those are the assumptions that start to get built and established. But when this cycle doesn't unfold like this, and there's lots of big hurts or consistent hurts, then it starts to, you know, create different assumptions. Maybe I don't matter, or maybe people can't be relied on. So just in a really practical way, an example that comes to mind, when one of my youngest was really young, we had driven to school, to church, basically school, right? We'd driven to church, and we get there, and we're sitting in the parking lot, and all of a sudden a hailstorm breaks out, and it sounds like the car is going to explode. And I look in the rearview mirror, and this little human being is looking like panic, like, and just to smile and say, hey, it's going to be okay. That's what she needed. Like, there was a threat, and me, as the caregiver, was able to say, you know what, I know that we're going to be okay, and then relay that, and then her emotions calm. Or another situation with my oldest child. I'm making breakfast on a Saturday morning, and she comes, hey, Dad, can you pick me up? No, can't. I'm making breakfast. And then her little brother falls and starts crying, and I go over and pick him up. And I notice that she's sad, my daughter, like, hey, what's up? Well, you love him and you don't love me. I'm like, what? How in the world did you get there? Well, I asked you to pick me up, and you said no, but then you picked him up. I'm like, oh, right, right. And those kind of interactions, really small things, start to build those assumptions. Now, big things do too, but I think if we can see those interactions through that lens and the assumptions they might be operating from or the things that show up, then that might give us opportunity to speak directly into those things. And that's part of attachment theory and really what it's trying to show or articulate. That these interactions, whether small or big, are the things that develop those relational assumptions. And for us to be thoughtful about what maybe are the relational assumptions that they're operating from, and then how do we minister into those. That relationships can be a real, they've been designed by God to be a resource, a place that we can go to for information, for protection, for help. And we've experienced that in life. Like, even the fact that we would do this as a group shows that relationships matter, and they can be a resource that we can draw on, but relationships are also a source of deep pain, that we can hurt each other in very deep ways. A lot of times, if you think about some of the most impactful experiences in your life, they've probably been relational, whether positive or negative. And just to be thoughtful of that as we think about our kids and how we interact with them and how those experiences have impacted them. And it's going to create difficulty. When they've had painful experiences, of course, it's going to be hard to trust. It's going to be hard to trust that you care for them. It's going to be hard for them to trust that they matter, that they have value and worth. Those are going to be really hard things for them to believe. It's going to be really hard for them to be able to regulate their emotions. You as an adult, as you're interacting with them and you're interacting and the interaction is hard, it's going to be difficult for you to regulate your emotions. That interpreting the events that occur are going to be really challenging. It's interesting, once you know something, it is really hard to be open to new information. Because you already know it. Your brain says, I know the answer here. I'm going to move on to things that I don't know. It's interesting, not too long ago, my wife was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about the United States and the location of Alaska. And this podcaster had just learned that Alaska isn't south of Texas. And it just blew her mind, right? And you just, of course, right? You go to school, and this is a very intelligent person. So, and my friend is my wife is talking to a friend, and she's like, what? No, I know where Alaska is, and it's south. Wait a second. Alaska's cold. And it just never registered, because the assumption had been built that this tells me where Alaska's at, and it's wrong. But you don't think anymore. Your brain turns off, and you move on to other things. And that's exactly what happens in attachment. Your early experiences tell you what reality is, and then that is reality, and what is actually the reality with you isn't what's actually driving behavior. It's not driving how you see things. It's the assumptions that's been built from our experiences. And I think for us to just be thoughtful about that sometimes what we're dealing with in the moment isn't actually what we're dealing with. And if we can keep that in mind, I think that can help us then, you know, intervene in helpful ways. And then connection, that of course where connection's been painful, then connection is going to be really hard to do. Now the good news of attachment though, the good news is that this gives us opportunity that our interaction is what can be healing. It's what can be painful and create false assumptions or assumptions that are not helpful, but it's also the medicine that we get to step into that space and help to recreate those assumptions. And that's what we've been talking about this morning, and such a great opportunity for us to step into. And I think that's the exciting news here, if we can see it. Now, I'm going to just kind of fly through some attachment styles. And the main thing here that I want you to be thinking about is not necessarily the four styles. That's not all that important. But just that, like, what's behind the behavior that you might be seeing that's challenging and that maybe it fits into one of these categories a little bit, and you may not even know, but it's helpful just to think about and consider because then that gives you direction of where to focus. So the anxious side of things, this is going to be, you know, they're fearful that they're not going to be loved, that they've answered that one of those fundamental questions of am I lovable or am I valuable as no. And so the fear is that I'm not lovable, that I will be rejected, and that leads to behavior that they can be pretty needy. Or they have a difficult time being okay if you're not okay. This actually sometimes is a kid that's really good, just really quiet and to their size, and they've kind of learned that, you know what, if I just stay out of the way and I don't cause any problems, then mom or dad are okay, other people are okay. If I'm just invisible, because I don't matter, and if I can just be invisible, it's going to be okay. And then if we know that, then that helps us speak in, think about, okay, what would be ways to communicate into that assumption that's not accurate? The avoidant, this is one that says, you know what, I know people are going to let me down, and I don't need people. So I'm going to keep it at a distance here. People are just going to let me down. They're going to hurt me. And so, you know, they maybe are going to be pretty angry and just like have no need for you. Now, again, some of this, it's not all driven by behavior. We are relational creatures and these things show up, but certainly there's personality and those sorts of things. Like my oldest daughter, when she turned 10, what she asked for was 1 hour when everybody left the house but her. That's all she wanted. Like, if you people would just leave me alone for an hour, I would be happy, okay? And it's like, okay, that's cheap, and we'll take the matches and, you know, turn off the electricity, and I think if an hour, I mean, surely it'll be okay. And so there's lots of factors here involved, but just to think about that and that we may need to press into, hey, I just want you to know I'm here. And the challenge here and the way these things get formed, because they're formed from early experiences, it's not like things that are here in the brain, right? It's really things that are in the gut. And so it's that disconnect. You've probably heard it before. I know it here, but I don't feel it here. And so it's not just information that helps shift this. It's really experience. It's information and experience. Because, you know, the experience really gets registered a lot of times in our mind and body implicitly, through implicit memory. And those things are encoded through emotion. They're encoded through sensation. They're encoded in those sorts of things that may not register consciously, but they show up in life. And then we try to shift them through information, then we get frustrated when it doesn't. Information should be part of the puzzle, but really experience is needed here. And then disorganized is really where there's difficulty on both sides of the equation. There's difficulty in like, yeah, I'm not loved, I'm not valued, as well as I can't trust others. And a lot of times this is going to show up when you have pretty significant trauma. And so one way to think about it, if you go back to the graphic that I showed early on, the anxious get lost in the seeking proximity. They get lost in, like, I'm anxious and I need you to calm it down, or I need you to be okay for me to be okay. The avoidant get lost in the exploring, like, okay, people aren't needed anymore, I'm just going to explore. And so then that gives us, again, insight in where we maybe would intervene. If they get lost in exploring, like letting them know, hey, I'm here and I'd be willing to walk with you for a bit. If they get lost in the seeking proximity, hey, I know, I am here and I'm glad to be a safe place for you. And how do we help you stretch into exploring just a bit? And then the secure, that would be where there's flexibility in the emotions and relational. So these would be the four categories that show up if you look at attachment. But again, the main point here is not necessarily the categories, but just trying to think about what are the underlying assumptions that are driving some of the behavior that you see, and then how might you minister into those. I think this can be a helpful, especially as kids get older, to think about what we want to actually try to hear by what they say. Right? So when they say I'm fine, what they maybe are actually meaning is that I long for a safe place. What we hear a lot of times is just leave me alone. But we, as relational creatures, we have longings, we have desires, and we need to be able to know and assume that those are there even when we don't see them and even when they're not able to recognize them and articulate them to us. For us to assume those are there so that we can minister in those. You don't care about me, or you're not my parent. Those sorts of things that can be really painful, really provocative, and to hear the longing that's behind that, and then how do we minister into that? So this week, as I was interacting with somebody that I'm close to and appreciate, who is an adult and walked through foster care and adoption, I had opportunity to visit with them, and I said, you know, I'm going to be speaking a little bit at this event. Is there anything that you would want that group of individuals to know? And so they shared some thoughts, and I just want to read those to you because I think they're really helpful and insightful, at least for us to think about. And this was what they had said. Let them, the child, or help them have a voice. Give them opportunity to have a voice and to share that, to let them know that you're interested in hearing what they have to say or what they're thinking. Another one was, don't give up on them. Hang in there with them. Now, this last part is a little bit longer, but I think it's worth reading. It says, I think often when we hear a child is adopted, we think how wonderful it is, especially when they are in a place of a good home. But there's so much loss for the child. I wish others would have taken the time to understand what I was going through. Often, people praise parents for taking kids in, but there's so much pain. Listening to others praise them was so hard when I was still feeling so unloved. And so again, just for, it's not that we want to hear these things and then panic and say, oh, I can't do anything. But I think we just need to be really thoughtful about what we say and how we approach these things. And the reality is that sometimes I hope today you're encouraged. And I hope today that you hear us saying you're stepping into a good thing. And also, too, to recognize that sometimes that can be really hard for those that we've come alongside, for them to hear that they have gone through so much. They've had really early experiences that have been painful. And even if they haven't been early, they've maybe been big, or maybe, you know what, they've had a lot of good experiences, but now they're at an age and they're trying to sort through, how do I make sense out of all of this that I experienced, you know, whether it was adoption or foster, like, how do I make sense of this at this point in life as they get older? Like, those are deep waters for them to walk through, and for us to be thoughtful about that and what they hear and what people articulate as we interact with them. And so why does this matter? I mean, to just go back to what we've already said, it matters because we're relational. And if we're relational, then we want to be thoughtful about these things so we can think about how to intervene. That it really helps bring understanding, and that hopefully that understanding then generates compassion. Because this is really hard stuff, right? I mean, you know that. When you're interacting and it's, you know, a behavior that's really hard from a 3-year-old to a 13-year-old to a 33-year-old, like, this is hard stuff. It is really hard stuff. And in that, too, that we're going to need a purpose. We're going to need purpose. Like, why are we doing this? What is this? You know, and I think a lot of times, sometimes I get the question of, like, is there any hope? And so the definitive answer to that is, yes, of course, there is hope. There's always hope. But we don't do these things because we're guaranteed certain outcomes. We try to step faithfully into the opportunities that we've been given or that we've chosen to take on. We try to be faithful to those things, and really we're not the determining factor in the outcomes. We have opportunity to reshape these playbooks, and what a glorious opportunity that is, right? That's a huge blessing and gift that we've been given the opportunity to work with and interact with. That I think in some ways, like, even if it's just for a few days, that we can see that as valuable. Like, we're providing protection, like, and that could be something to step into. And beyond that, that, you know, beyond protection, there's opportunity to reshape some of those fundamental assumptions that hopefully help them over time take root so that they would be able to love God and love others. That they would be able to receive God's love and receive the love for others. Like, what a great purpose. And so, and that too, that this matters because provide direction, on how we might intervene, that we might be able to help them see that I see you. Hey, I noticed when this happened, and I'm curious, what was that like for you? Or this person said this when we were there, I'm wondering, how did that register? Or, you know, just, I see you. Or safety, that, hey, you can come to me, and I'd be glad to try to be protective or helpful. Security, that I'm going to be here, and that we're careful not to make promises that we can't keep. And that we can help calm, we can be a calming presence as we interact with them. You know, medicine is a wonderful thing, but sometimes medicine doesn't taste very good. Now, I'm amazed at how far that has come. I don't know. I'm like, this medicine seems to take a lot more like candy these days than I was like, man, yeah, I'll take some of that too. But in this realm, the medicine of relationships just does not taste good a lot of times. And so, because there's been such a source of pain, so in that, to see this progression of movement, if we are able to move these assumptions along, that's going to be a slow process. It's going to be a little dose here and a little dose there, and they maybe are going to spit it out and say, ah, that doesn't taste good, or like, you know what, that wasn't bad, but then next time around, it will be. You know, that it's going to take some time and opportunity. And that we want to help them see that relationships, while they are really a source of life, that they're not a source of identity. That and this can be more of the anxious side of things, that they can see that they are who that what they do or who we say that they are, or they're only as good as how they're able to calm other people's emotions. So as we kind of move here towards a close, I want to just talk about just a few considerations that kind of connect with some of the things that we've already talked about. And this little graphic over to the side, one of the things, as a counselor, there's just been moments in the counseling room that have impacted me and will impact me for the rest of my life. And I'm really grateful for that. And this picture over here represents one of those, that there was somebody that I was meeting with. And it was week after week of, it was obvious there was a lot of pain, but week after week, sitting in silence for 45 minutes. And all I would get is, I'm fine, and I'm fine, and I knew that wasn't. And eventually, they handed me their notebook, and it said, I'm fine, and then you turn the page over, and the I'm fine is turned upside down, and it says, save me. And it was just like one of those moments, like I knew something was there. I mean, it was obvious, but now for that to be able to be on the table. And it wasn't like they were in a dangerous situation at home. That wasn't what it was safe for me from. It was like they had been through such profound relational hurts that they just could not sort through it. And I'll never forget that moment or that graphic. And again, the hope here is just to be able to say, to see that there are things that are going on behind the eyeballs, that are going on in the mind and in the body, that they can't even put words to it. And if we can see those things, that might help us join them and minister into them. Not because it's going to change overnight, but because that's part of what Christ does for us, and that we get the opportunity to step into that. And so that, I think, directly then ties into attunement. And attunement basically just means to notice, to pay attention, to see what's going on in those small things, and when we do, to follow up on those things so that we can help in reconstructing some of those assumptions, to see their wounded heart and to come alongside those things that have been established. And pace is one of those things. I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but it's helpful for me in the midst of the path. It's like, oh, I don't know what to do. And I think in so many ways, parenting isn't necessarily what we do. It's really more about the posture of how we go about it. And pace is one of those things that helps me in that. And the P stands for to be playful. Like, if we can just be playful, there's something about that that really helps bring the defenses down and then gives us opportunity then to minister into some of those assumptions. The A is accepting. I think we are really good at telling them what they ought to do, what they ought to feel, and what they, you know, all of those, and they're true. Those are true. So it's not to say that we shouldn't do that, but we sometimes just get caught in providing correction and information rather than, let me just hear where they're at. And then the C connects to that as well, and that's curious. To be curious, to be an investigator of like, okay, I'm curious, what is going on here? What, you know, what do you think about this? Or, and in that then, to try to be accepting rather than, you know, moving into the correction, because, you know, all kids, I mean, they just don't know much, right? They don't know much, and so there's a lot of things to correct, no matter whether they're biological, foster, adopted, or between. Like, it's just, there's lots of correction. Empathy, to empathize, to recognize the loss. And I think if we can interact with that kind of a posture of playfulness and acceptance and curiosity and empathy, that puts us in a really good position to try to connect and see these relational assumptions that are underneath and then help try to shift those in a helpful direction. And then this here, just to recognize that you have your own wounds. You have your own relational assumptions and how what comes up for you. When you're frustrated with another person, do you start to retreat and say, I don't need you? I mean, that's where I go. I just kind of pull back. Or does it move you into that anxious pursuing and I'm not okay unless you're okay? And so just to recognize you carry those two, and that's okay. We want to know those things so that we can kind of intervene there in them. And then lastly, just wanted to read this here, Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 10. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, as a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. But here's the piece I really wanted to focus on for just a second here. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them. That you've been created by him, and that he's put this in front of you. If you're involved in this ministry of parenting, that he's created you and he's put this in front of you for you to walk into it. He's equipped you, and that it's not just stepping into it, but then it's also like if we've stepped into it, how do we step into it in a thoughtful way, in a way that's trying to be aware of the reality of the hurts and pains that are there and how we can minister into those in a way that is life-giving. So it's been a privilege to be with you, and it's never wise to stay in between lunch and an audience. So thanks for the opportunity to be with you today.